Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's National Economic Transition Platform release. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call may be recorded, and I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Executive Director of the Just Transition Fund, Heidi Binko. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you so much, Chloe. And good afternoon, everyone. And thank you for joining us today for the release of our National Economic Transition Platform. My name is Heidi Binko, and I am the co-founder and executive director of the Just Transition Fund. Since 2015, we've been addressing the economic distress in communities across the United States, where both coal plants and mines have closed. We find, fund, and scale innovative, local, community-driven models to help the people in the places hardest hit by the changing coal economy. In early 2019, the Just Transition Fund launched our National Economic Transition Initiative, or our NET initiative, because we saw an opportunity for local leaders from affected communities from all across the United States to come together, unite around their common needs, and craft a vision for an ambitious federal coal transition program. From our national perspective, the fund identified the country's best examples of community economic development, workforce, and community organizing that was happening in coal communities. And we brought together the most visionary local, tribal, and labor leaders. After an extensive year-long engagement process, which was supported by the fund, our planning team produced the National Economic Transition Platform. Built on seven pillars, the platform presents a framework for federal action that will create vibrant, resilient, and equitable economies with thriving local businesses and family-sustaining jobs. The seven aspects of the pillar include, number one, investing in supporting local leaders and organizations to lead the transition, especially Black, Brown women and Indigenous-led organizations. Number two, support local small businesses and entrepreneurship. The third pillar is provide a bridge for workers to quality family-sustaining jobs. Fourth, reclaim and remediate coal sites. Fifth, improve physical and social infrastructure. And our sixth pillar is hold coal companies accountable during bankruptcies. And then the seventh and final pillar focuses on creating and improving access to make sure that communities have the resources that they need. So today, we're calling on federal policymakers to make a big, bold investment in an ambitious new national community and worker transition program. The livelihoods of thousands of communities and tens of millions of people that rely on us to get this right. Creating economic opportunity has never been so important, especially as the COVID pandemic and the resulting economic recession are making conditions in these communities even more dire. So now I'd like to introduce you to six of our speakers who represent a variety of coal communities across the country and a range of disciplines. Our speakers today include Brendan Dennison, who's the CEO of Coalfield Development Corporation, Veronica Koptis, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Coalfield Justice, Jimmy Slevin, who's the President of the Utility Workers Union of America, Tony Skrilunas, who's a team leader with Trog Awaken, Peter Hilly, who is the president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development, and Dennis Doherty, who is the executive director of the Colorado AFL-CIO. And with that, I'd like to turn the call over to our first speaker, Brendan from Coalfield Development. Brendan, go ahead.
Thank you, Heidi, and hello, everybody. Coalfield Development is an organization based in southern West Virginia in coal country. And we invest in and incubate social enterprises, and the social enterprises are designed to, A, put people back to work in an area that even before COVID has struggled with very high rates of poverty and unemployment, and B, our enterprises are designed to model what a more sustainable and diversified economy can look like. We helped start the first solar installation company in our community. We have a sustainable agriculture business. And we have a collar construction crew, just to name a few examples. So we're trying to build the workforce of the future. We're trying to develop the job training and the job skills that are going to be needed for the new economy. And we're so excited to be part of the NET because we feel like this represents the kind of level of investment that's really going to be needed to get this transition right. and to not leave in the dust the communities that have really powered this country for several generations now. And, you know, for me personally, a lot of times I feel like coal communities are thought of as collateral in the climate change discussion. You know, we're going to have to make a change, and that's going to hurt those coal communities, and that's too bad. And so, yes, we should help them. But it's like a burden. It's thought of as a burden to this transition. And really what I see here in West Virginia is coal communities can be the leaders of this transition. And our workforce has a lot of the skills that are going to be needed in the more sustainable, cleaner, and really fairer, more fair economy of the future. So we're thrilled to be a part of this effort, and we really believe in this document that's been put forward. And with that, I would love to introduce Veronica Koptis, who's Executive Director of the Center for Coalfield Justice. Veronica?
Yeah, thanks, Brandon. So as Brandon said, I'm Veronica Koptis. I'm with the Center for Coalfield Justice. We are an environmental and economic justice advocacy organization that works in the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania. We deeply invest in those that are most impacted by the problems facing our community. And many of our leaders and members grew up adjacent to coal mining operations, and also several of them come directly from coal mining families. Our local economy in southwestern Pennsylvania and infrastructure are dependent on coal mining operations, but we are seeing the signs of big companies bailing on our towns, as they have done so in so many other places across the country, including some of the partners on this call with me today. COVID-19 has drained what little resources we have left by shuttering local businesses and putting people living paycheck to paycheck out of work. Unlike in some other coal fields across the country, southwestern Pennsylvania still has significant active coal operations that are profitable and potentially could be for years. And this has upheld the political control on our system from the coal industry. And so a lot of the work we have been doing is one of the values in the NET, and why we are excited to participate in it, is investing deeply in local leadership. So last summer, our team canvassed these communities in Greene and Washington counties to hear what they wanted to see change for their local economy and teach them and work with them on how to get engaged. There was overwhelming support for things very similar in the NET seven steps, which was cleaning up the messes that were left behind by industry, increasing access to good unionized paying jobs, and really looking at our communities holistically and how to improve them from education, healthcare, food access, et cetera. And these local leaders are now working to push elected officials who have been resistant to addressing any transition planning needs to move that process forward, being driven by the community. And our vision for our communities moving forward have to require recognizing the inequities in the access to jobs of people of color, women, and young folks, and ensure that as we transition, service sector jobs are valued and paid a living wage, just like the coal worker jobs are and have been in the past. And also that in Appalachia, particularly caregiving, which so many women across the coal fields have done unpaid for decades, is honored and compensated moving forward. Our vision is that our schools are thriving, that tax bases are created, not pushing that burden on the already impoverished to fill the gaps in our education system. Our parks are protected, and our access to healthcare is readily available. And unfortunately, in southwestern Pennsylvania, our federal leadership, legislators who represent our communities, have largely failed workers and residents in this region by keeping their loyalty to CEOs and shareholders. But now, in this critical moment, they have a beautiful opportunity to stand on the right side of history with other national leaders across the country and finally change the path for coalfield communities and the rest of the country to deeply invest in these struggling places across the country where solutions are being pushed by brilliant residents and innovators who are the most impacted by the problems. And with that, I will send you all over to Jimmy Slevin, who is president of the Utility Worker Union of America.
Thank you, Veronica. I appreciate it. As Veronica said, my name is Jimmy Slevin. I'm the president of the Utility Workers Union of America. We represent about 50,000 members working in America's utility sector, including in the electric, gas, water, steam, and related professionals industries. Unfortunately, our members have witnessed the impacts of power plant closure firsthand, including the loss of hundreds of jobs for people directly employed in the operations and maintenance of these large facilities. As we all know, the rippling effects go far beyond job losses. When communities lose annual tax revenue, education suffers, home values drop, and the fabric of these communities change forever. I'll give you an example. For our members impacted at plant closure in Adams County with Dayton Power and Light, the facility directly and indirectly employed nearly 700 people at two coal-fired plants, including 490 employees and about 200 contracted employees. These two plants generated around $9 million in annual property tax for the county. The Manchester School District alone received $5.6 million in annual revenue from these plants. Our members, whose impact experienced a double blow in losing their livelihoods and their communities. So you could see the challenges for the impact by closures range from difficult to nearly insurmountable. The fact is, coal plant closures are changing regions and ways of life too rapid for small communities to adapt on their own. We cannot allow these closures to continue in an unimaginable fashion. The Just Transition Fund National Economic Transition Framework offers lawmakers and community leaders an inclusive, community-driven approach to address this urgent crisis. This framework goes far beyond towards recognizing the contributions made by these workers and the communities to build the nation. We fully support all seven pillars outlined here, specifically the providing a bridge for workers and holding coal companies accountable for their bankruptcy, for pensions and benefit programs our members paid into, resonates with our memberships. Thank you for all the organizations put their head together on this important framework that will help provide workers and communities the opportunity to remain vibrant places where families live and work. I also want to send a thanks to Jim Harrison from the UWA for working on this, and we're especially thankful to the Blue-Green Alliance for their expertise that brought this work. The work underscores why the UWA is part of the BGA Alliance partnership. Now, tens of millions of people in these communities are depending on us now to make the bold and economic investment to get this transition right. I appreciate your time today. And now I'm going to turn it over to Tony Skrilos from Tribal Awakening.
Thank you, James. And good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you're calling in from. My name is Tony Skrilos. I am a member of Navajo Nation. I come from a community of Black Mesa. I was raised right near the coal mines, and my dad was a welder. That was his career. You know, he retired from that and became a community leader. But what we do with Tribe Awakening is we're heavily involved in transition work. We advise solar development. We actually are partners in a company called Navajo Power, where we're doing the first utility scale work on Navajo that's ever been done. We advise on retail centers, tourism. And so that's really where there's massive opportunity. Why this is important to us is that these power companies currently have resulted in our tribes becoming very dependent. In the past, this was really the only economic option for tribes. When the treaties were set up and when the modern economies were developed, a lot of our governments were created really to approve mineral leases and oil exploration. And so our tribal governments are set up to really be built around these kinds of industries. But now we all realize that there's a need to transition. And it's a serious issue to us. Just for example, we had a recent power plant close here called the Navajo Generating Station and adjacent Kayenta coal mine. This closure resulted in an 80% reduction in revenues to the Hopi tribe and a 25% reduction in revenue to the Navajo Nation. And if you look at the communities, I mean, like Hopi has 12 communities, population of around 30,000. Navajo has 110 chapters. They're rural communities with a population of over 300,000. So these are significant revenue drivers, but the real opportunity and challenge is that everything around us is moving towards renewable energy. Everything around us is about a movement to get off resource extractive industry and coal mining and power plants. California is going towards 100% renewables. Colorado, New Mexico, Utah at some point is going to be having those discussions. Arizona. So these are our markets, and I think the handwriting is on the wall. So why this is important, this platform is important to us, is that it really lays out. It's been done, developed with major tribal participation. We've had community meetings. We've had a lot of outreach. There are several of us that are tribal members that are NGO leaders in our communities, and we've helped put this together. And we really have had a voice, and we really want the nation to acknowledge and to partner up with us on this transition. And we think that that transition is going to be beautiful. We really see opportunities in all areas of resulting from this platform. So thank you. And at this point, I want to I have the honor of introducing Peter Hilly, who's president of the MACED. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Tony, and thanks to everyone for joining us today. As Tony said, my name is Peter Hilly, and I'm the president of the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development in Kentucky. The coal fields of Appalachia, like coal-producing communities around the country, literally fueled the growth of the entire nation. Despite that, the coal economy didn't create lasting prosperity in these communities. In fact, today, these are some of the most economically disadvantaged places in the United States. These places that have given so much now bear the brunt of changes in global energy markets. They sacrifice lives, health, water, ecosystems. There is a debt to be paid. Justice demands that we bring new investment to these places, the investment needed to build a new economy, the investment needed to revitalize these communities, the investment needed to educate people of all ages to be prepared for new opportunities, and the investment needed to create demonstrations of what the new economy can look like, whether that is local food, healthcare, the creative economy, sustainable forestry, tourism, or clean energy. The second pillar of our national economic transition platform calls upon policymakers to invest in this kind of restorative economic development in our communities. Here are just a few examples of what we're talking about. Over the past year, the Mountain Association for Community Economic Development has invested more than $1 million in solar installations for small businesses and nonprofits in the coal fields of Kentucky, saving money for these vital local enterprises and making them more resilient as energy prices rise. This is also reducing their carbon footprint. We've invested in a local wood products manufacturer, helping them double in size, adding good jobs with benefits, and using sustainably harvested timber. We've helped addiction recovery centers get established and grow, meeting a critical need. And we've trained former coal miners to work in the new clean energy economy and helped them start their own businesses in this growing market. There's a lot more work to be done, but there is hope and determination in these places and a fierce commitment to a brighter future. These communities can thrive again. They just need a fair chance. And that's what the National Economic Transition Platform is all about. And now I'd like to introduce Dennis Dougherty, Executive Director of the Colorado AFL-CIO. Dennis?
Hey, thank you, Peter. So the Colorado AFL-CIO represents 185 affiliate unions whose membership totals more than 130,000 hardworking Coloradans. And we are an expression of the hopes and aspirations of the working families of Colorado. As we know, America is in the middle of an energy transition. And here in Colorado, we knew we needed to have a conversation about getting ahead of this transition and fulfilling our moral obligation to coal-impacted workers and communities. That's why last year, alongside Environmental Allies and the Blue-Green Alliance, we fought for and passed legislation targeted on workers and communities impacted by our state's declining use of coal. We know that working people should not suffer economically due to changing demand in the energy economy and a shift to cleaner and cheaper energy sources. We cannot leave workers or communities behind as these changes happen in our economy, which are also the changes necessary to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. A transition that's fair for workers isn't something that will just happen organically. We have to choose to invest in the economic diversification of both communities and workers. We have to make the choice. We have to choose to make the jobs in the clean economy family-sustaining union jobs. And that's why we were excited to be part of the effort to work with the Just Transition Fund and partners from across coal communities and groups throughout the Just Transition space, like the Blue-Green Alliance, to develop the National Economic Transition Platform. Critically, this platform reflects many of the ideas and learnings from our bills here, which we are analyzing in Colorado, which includes a robust package of support for workers, wage replacement, ensuring health care and retired benefits, and retirement benefits, and support for paid training. It also calls for the establishment of an advisory committee, the National Economic Trends Platform, Economic Transition Platform does, which we do as well here in Colorado, to ensure that key stakeholders, including labor unions, community leaders, and others, have a seat at the table when decisions are being made. It also links to projects that are community-driven and economic development efforts to ensure that the project actually meets the needs of the community. We hope this platform serves as a roadmap for federal policymakers to the big, bold investment in economic growth and solutions that work for everybody. Back to you, Heidi.
Great, Dennis. Thank you. Thank you so much, and thank you to all of our speakers today. I'm going to throw it back now to the operator who will help us and introduce the Q&A.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. And once again, for your questions today, that is star and one. We'll pause a moment to allow any questions to queue. And once again, for your questions today, that is star and one. And we'll take our first question from James Bruggers with Inside Climate News. Please go ahead.
excuse me. Yeah, thank you for making this available to us today. I appreciate it. I missed the beginning segment. I apologize, but was there a price tag that was put on this plan? It would be one question if you have any idea about what kind of a dollar investment do you think is needed to get it to the scale that would actually impact communities in a positive way. And the more specific examples of like how you see this, what are the programs that you would invest in would be helpful. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much for your question. In terms of the federal price tag, what we've really done is try to really balance the creation of an ambitious program with the understanding that it needs a big, bold investment, but we're trying to balance that with the cost of really creating sustainable and inclusive economic growth against what the cost of the status quo has been, which really puts the livelihoods of people and millions of people at risk, as a lot of key infrastructure needs like education and healthcare and other things crumble. And so we really feel like these coal communities have been forgotten for too long, and we don't have a number in the platform, but we are calling for an ambitious and bold investment at this time. And why don't I actually open up this question to see if any of the other speakers have commentary on that aspect of the question before we talk about the second piece of the question.
Yeah, this is Brandon with Coalfield Development. I might just add that it's been a community-driven process, so most of us are not policy analysts by trade, and so we wanted to be really thoughtful. We didn't want to pick an arbitrary number and slap it on there, but we're committed to the process to nail that down, and we all know it needs to be a lot more than what it has been so far.
Any other comments from the speakers before we move on to the second part of the question?
Yes, Heidi, this is Peter Hilly, and I just want to observe that the Appalachian Regional Commission, through the Power Program over the last several years, has put about $250 million of additional funding into just the Appalachian region, and we can see a lot of good results from that, but I think it would be hard to describe it as more than a really good start. So as we think about the ambition of this, we've got to think about orders of magnitude beyond that. And I believe that the recent investments in the recovery to the COVID pandemic have given us a different view and a different way of thinking about federal investment that's needed to support the economy. So we are, as Heidi said, calling for some serious ambition here.
Thanks. Operator, could we perhaps go on to the second question?
Move next to Zach Coleman from Politico. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks for holding this call. So in the platform, a lot of the buckets are things that we've heard about before for how to invest in a ground-up Appalachian, economic, sustainable economy. What's the new ask here? I mean, what needs to be done? Hasn't already been worked on? Like, what are you going to Congress with? Like, what is the big ask?
Before I open that up to our speakers, I would say that we really modeled this over after the Power Program, which we felt like was a good start to addressing these issues. And one of the things about Power that was really appealing was the fact that it had at its core interagency cooperation. I think what we've all seen in the last number of years is that addressing this issue is going to be really complex and intersectional, and it's going to require a lot of different coordination, not only by different agencies, but across different sectors of government between the federal and the state level. And so what we're seeing with this platform is more of an intersectional approach, one that is more comprehensive than anything that we've seen to date. Why don't I just pause there and open it up to any of the speakers who might want to comment on that question as well.
I think the very short answer to what we're asking for that's different is one word, scale. We have proven out a lot of approaches that can be a part of this comprehensive need and addressing this need in these communities. What we need is the federal commitment to take those approaches to scale.
And any other comments,
Heidi,
from
Peter,
our speakers?
Yeah, Heidi, mm-hmm. And Peter, this is Tony Skrilanis. I think what's different too is the inclusion of tribal communities. Participation has shown we have communities that are heavily dependent on coal mines and power plants, and we're all facing transition. And it's very unique because a lot of our nations are sovereign, and we also have the cultural differences. So what this platform really acknowledges is those differences and really works to include the tribal communities and the opportunities that we have. A lot of us, we have power plants, coal mines, and a lot of power infrastructure, power lines running across our lands, and a lot of our communities have grown up with this, so we want to be part of the transition, and we have real strong strategies. We think that tribes can be really benefiting from a strong transition. They can actually change the future too, instead of being passive participants where they're just leasing the land and getting revenue from taxes. The tribes now assert that they want to actually co-own and drive the development. So So a lot of the values and the principles that are laid out in this platform really support that, you know, support local leaders and building them up, support the investment and the economic analysis and the tools to really make that happen.
Heidi, this is Dennis with Colorado AFL-CIO. I just briefly, you know, this lifts up bridge of support for workers that previously, in terms of the breadth, I believe has not been seen. And one thing I want to specifically point out in here is the wage differential and replacement, right, that would ensure that the workers who powered, you know, our nation for generations don't get left by the wayside, and that they have a fighting chance for whatever's next.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, thanks for that. And also, you also prompted me, I believe, that the first question also focused on the first reporter was looking for some specific examples of transition solutions. And so let's actually maybe take a few minutes, Brandon, and maybe over to Peter. Could you maybe provide a few specific examples of what you're seeing? Tony, you as well, too, of what you're seeing in your communities that work regarding specific community economic development solutions to these problems.
Yes, this is Brandon with Coalfield Development in West Virginia. We're really big on social enterprises because a lot of job training programs, there has been a lot of talk about job training programs, but not a lot of them have worked very well because the jobs just are not there on the back end. Our communities are so damaged environmentally, but also economically. And so a social enterprise is a unique strategy and a very specific model to help get new businesses going. But to really do a blended approach, a public-private partnership approach, to ensure that there's job training, yes, but that there's actual investment in the businesses that are needed to employ the new people that are trained.
Yeah, thank you for that, Brandon. This is Peter. We're seeing enormous opportunities in the energy sector. There's a very real demand for solar for small businesses and nonprofits. They recognize it as a way to reduce their costs. We're able to finance that in a way that makes the debt service cash neutral or even cash positive. And this is a form of investment that pays for itself, and it creates jobs in the process while also stabilizing these vital community institutions. Just one example, the Hemp Hill Community Center in Letcher County, Kentucky, we helped them put solar panels on the roof. It's reducing their energy costs by thousands of dollars, which is helping them keep the doors open where they are training people coming out of recovery programs to bake bread and pizzas to literally feed their community. So it ties all of those pieces together.
Thanks, yeah, Peter. Any other comments from our speakers?
Well, Heidi, I guess maybe two examples. One example is with an NG Navajo Generating Station closure. I feel like our community didn't have a chance to really respond. It was very abrupt, and we didn't do a lot of economic planning and preparation of our companies. You know, we have many companies. For example, Navajo Nation owns a construction company called NECA, Navajo Engineering and Construction Authority, that has over 350 workers. They could have been doing a lot of the work on the reclamation at both the Navajo Generating Station site or up at Peabody. But the closures happened so fast, and that a lot of the contracting was done very, very fast. And now if we had prepare those communities and help them think through all the business opportunities, and really help invest into some of the companies so that they're ready to do the work, it really would have been a different picture. And we had a big summit last year. We've done a lot of education to the communities around just what to ask for, you know, what kind of things to look for when you're doing a utility scale renewable energy project, what kind of benefits you should ask for, what is there equity that the community or the tribe can secure, and the benefits are significant. Just as an example, there's like a 200 megawatt project will create about 700 jobs for a year and a half. That means that there's 700 workers in the community. They need places to stay, places to eat. Where are those workers going to come from? Are they going to be all recruited off-res? Out on Navajo and a lot of tribal communities, there's a tribal preference laws, you know. And then there's more and more business opportunity laws where the contracting should be local. So the tribes are responding from their side, but there's a real need for capacity and investment. So there's ample opportunity. And the tribes out here in this area, we've had summits, as I mentioned, and they want to really, they see a real need for better retail. We have over 80% leakage of, you know, a dollar that's earned on our reservations, over 80% of it leaves immediately off reservation. Incredible opportunities in those areas. Tourism, we capture less than 7% of the dollars that come on our lands. You know, the tourists that come through our lands, we only capture 7%. Again, massive opportunities. So a lot of economic planning and the development can happen around those sectors.
Thanks, Tony. Next question in the queue.
And once more for your questions today, that is star and one on your touch tone phone. Pause a moment to allow further questions to queue. And we will take a follow-up from James Bruggers. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Other than talking to us, do you have, what is your strategy for getting support for this? And I mean, we've got a big election coming up, so you could talk about how you make this different this time.
Any thoughts from the speakers?
This is Veronica with the Center for Coalfield Justice, and again, we work in southwestern Pennsylvania. I think, you know, in the area that we're working in, there still needs to be a lot of, like, political education and work around what does our economy look like after coal, because we do still have a pretty dominant coal operations, and we plan on using this with residents in the community to do education around what's possible. We've been very fortunate to learn from others on this call and that participated in the NET process around, you know, we don't have to recreate the wheel. There are clear examples that are already beneficial and helpful to move forward. And then in terms of being an election year, as a 501c3, we engage in a lot of voter education. And so we plan on asking candidates who are running at the state and federal level whether they support this platform, or if they were to win at the state level or they were to win at the federal level, would they work with others in moving these types of visions and values forward and invest in this stuff, and having them answer that question and making sure voters are aware of where they stand on it.
Thanks, Veronica. Dennis, from the Colorado perspective, would you like to add anything?
Thanks, Heidi. And we have worked here both within labor and with environmental justice, environmental groups, faith-based groups, community groups, and also through the Blue Green Alliance to raise awareness and buy-in around a lot of these elements. And we've been doing that for over a year now.
Great. Thanks, Dennis. Any other thoughts or comments?
Yeah, Heidi, this is Jimmy Slevin from the Utility Workers Union of America. We've seen huge changes in the energy sector and in our jobs, and just even in how work is being done and produced today. We're making sure that as we enter the political cycle that the conversation is going on state levels and local levels and even federal levels, to make sure that when people are talking about just transition, it's not just moving the energy sector, it's moving the jobs and moving all of the communities with it. A true transition means that it all moves. And we've seen too far, too long, how certain communities have been left behind as as they transition to other sectors. And we're making sure that those voices are heard and that the utility workers are platformed on making sure as we transition into a cleaner energy country that we do make sure that we're not forgotten or left behind. And that's from our children to our workers.
Great. Thanks, Jimmy. Do we have any other questions in the queue?
We'll move next to Matt Brown with the Associated Press. Please go ahead.
Hi, appreciate all y'all's time. So the current administration obviously has been trying to promote coal and trying to find various ways to, seems to whether it's extending the life of the industry by coming up with alternative uses or by easing regulations. I'm wondering if that to y'all is in any fashion complementary to what you're doing insofar as it would make the transition period extend the transition period, or do you see that as an impediment to what you're trying to do?
Thanks, Matt, for your question. Brandon, would you like to maybe respond to that first?
Well, I can just say being so dependent on one extractive industry here in West Virginia has just made us very, very vulnerable, and it's led to a lot of pain and suffering. It's just not been a good strategy. So what we're talking about here is economic diversification and not putting all our eggs in one basket, especially an extractive basket, but really trying to rebuild our economy to be much more resilient and much more sustainable and much more fair to our workers.
This is Peter. I would just add to that that coal didn't collapse because of regulation. Coal collapsed because natural gas from fracking became so much cheaper. And there's nothing that can be done in the regulatory front that's going to change that economic reality. So I think we need to keep building toward the future, not trying to claw our way back to the past.
And this is Veronica. I really think what Peter and Brandon said is critical. And I know recently the Department of Energy is like announced they're going to invest $122 million in coal alternatives. And I think of the little, like what communities could do with community-driven projects with $122 million would extend so much further than what a coal company is going to do trying to kind of get their numbers by to make a profit for 1 year versus investing that level of resource into places that are struggling, that are sort of putting it in the values of this platform of community-driven economic diversity, and that could get communities, you know, 5 years, 10 years moving forward instead of a one-year Band-Aid fix.
This is Tony. Just to add to what has been said, for tribes, especially Navajo Nation here, we've really been dependent on coal and power plants. And for a long time, the leadership has supported those industries. I think now, as Peter pointed out, that the driver here is really economics and natural gas prices and really the markets in the area, for our area, the power markets. So that transition is happening, and our tribal leaderships are a lot more accepting of that transition, and really they want to do it right. I think there's also a real concern for how we do it in the future. How do we participate in the new economy? We don't want to, as I was explaining before, just be passive participants anymore, and we really want to be drivers. So that's really what our leadership is doing, is really putting together like an energy team and doing participating in a major power purchase opportunity that was put together by Salt River Project, just as an example, who's one of the owners of the NGS power plant. So I see this as an opportunity to educate tribal communities in a really a new way. I mean, a lot of our people are proud of the mining jobs, and a lot of my people are welders, and they're very proud workers. But they also recognize what's happening, and we want to take that pride into the new industry. We want to take those skill sets and apply them to renewable energy, into new sectors of development.
Great. Thanks, Tony. I'm curious, do we have another question in the queue for our speakers?
We do. We'll take our next question from James Marshall with E&E News. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is James from E&E. Thanks for holding this conference. You answered one of my questions about workforce training and I guess how to have community buy-in and make sure those training programs have seats filled and jobs at the end of those programs. I'm also wondering about relocation. I know in the platform it says that, you know, there's a bullet point about, you know, making sure relocation is paid for by employers. I'm wondering if a displacement is sort of an inevitable part of this transition, or if they're trying to combat that.
Thoughts to address this part of the question? Maybe, Dennis, how about I toss it to you first?
Yeah, thank you, Heidi. Relocation is definitely important in terms of, you know, making the workers whole. The ground-up approach to this transition platform, we hope, would make it that the communities ultimately decide, you know, what's next for them and what's most important, and any incentives to retain workers who are already located there. I don't know if that gets to your question.
Well, and Heidi, this is Brandon with Coalfield Development. I would say that, you know, the way our current system is set up, relocation probably does become inevitable, but I think that's really a failure of our current system, and it's really not right that some communities feel like their only way to survive is predicated on serving one industry, and we have to do better than that.
Great. Thanks, Brendan. Yeah, across the communities that we work with, the Just Transition Fund across the country, there's a strong desire to make these communities whole and to make them attractive places to work so that young people and families can stay. So, you know, just echoing what was said earlier, you know, ultimately it's the community's decision how things move forward, but we see that quite often. There's a stronger desire to stay than there often is to relocate. I think we have time for maybe just one more question, because we do have a hard stop at 2:00. So do we have another question in the queue?
Yes, we'll take our last question from Catherine Hamilton with the Energy Gang. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. This is Catherine Hamilton. I'm one of the hosts of the Energy Gang, which some of you may listen to. It's a podcast. My question is around investment. I know you've talked about having big federal investment in this type of program, and it makes all kinds of sense to me. But another piece might be all of this private sector funding out there that is looking for places to land and doesn't always pick your locations as places to invest because of the perceived risks. And I'm just wondering if you all have thought about how do you actually try to leverage not just federal dollars, but how do you bring in private sector financing and have this sort of economic development be really attractive to those funders?
Yeah, this is Peter. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, Peter, go ahead. I was actually going to call on you. Go ahead.
Well, I think that this is one of the ways that we can use federal dollars is to leverage more of that private investment. And we can do that with a variety of tools and ways that we build capital stacks so that the first risk money maybe is coming from the federal government, and that helps to protect the other investments. Or we have loss reserves that are provided by the federal government. We've established some tools like that, and it really helps to leverage those additional investments. The venture capital
is heavily concentrated on the East and West Coast. It doesn't come in to the rural areas across the country, to Appalachia in particular. And frankly, a lot of what we need is not so much those big multi-million-dollar deals as investment that allows for hundreds of small businesses to flourish in ways that really recreate communities as places where people can and choose to live. And I think as people contemplate the recovery from the pandemic that we're in, we're going to see a lot of people looking to rural places and saying, hey, maybe that's a better place for me. And then we've got to create all of the amenities that make these livable places for them. And that's food, that's healthcare, that's infrastructure, water, broadband, of course, is a big part of that. So lots of opportunities for investment.
Any other comments on the question of matching your leveraging private investment?
Hey, Heidi, this is Jimmy Slevin from the Utility Workers again. So it's vitally important to understand that as the plant's been closing, there has been some great structures already there and investments back into it. You know, too long have we forgotten and just closed plants and walked away from a lot of those grid structures. Roads have been built and schools have been built on some of the backspaces from these plants. We need to make sure that they're used and not forgotten. And then also that as we look at community base, these are men and women who have worked in these areas for a long time, and generations have worked at these plants and these mines. They don't want to leave. They want to build their communities. They don't want them to just be dumped on the wayside. And there's a lot of talent and skill sets there. And that's why it's big about community-driven, because they know the best for their community. And that's why it's vitally important to get the private investors to understand it. Also, those who are leaving us, those plants that are leaving us, hold them accountable. They've made millions off these communities, and we have to hold them accountable to what they're doing and just walking away with, and hold them accountable to that community, because they deserve, the people of the community deserve it. The youth of that community deserve better, too.
And Heidi, this is Tony. I wanted to add that, you know, as tribal peoples, we're not moving anywhere. A lot of the movement is going to be temporary after these closures. But I think what the perfect blend, you know, where the federal dollars, the public dollars really goes into helping our communities get educated and get organized. We can do economic planning. We can build capacity of local leaders, create local institutions. A lot of the dollar types that Peter talked about in terms of venture cap, impact investment, even grant dollars, very little of those dollars ever reach Indian country. There was a recent study that showed that less than 1% of all philanthropic dollars reaches tribal nations. And of that, even less goes to tribally controlled entities. No venture cap at all, very little impact investment. There's a real cultural divide, and that's where the public dollars can really help build that capacity so that some of those dollars reach our communities. I think we're being recognized now, and we're finally in the space and in the discussions nationally, but we really need to use some of those public dollars to build that wherewithal so we can access those private dollars.